Models of Discipleship. The 59th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 20th, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This morning is going to be a bit of an excursus. I hope it's helpful. I'm going to look at three verses here just to indicate what prompted this, and then we'll look at the handout and go over the handout together. We're in Luke 12, chapter 12, verse 13, and if you have your text in front of you, it doesn't really matter. We won't look at it that much. But it says, "Someone in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me.' But he said to him, 'Man, who appointed me a judge or arbitrator over you?' Then he said to them, 'Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions.'" And he's going to go on to talk about greed and financial security and those kinds of issues. That's what's coming up. But what prompts it is this interchange with a man who comes up to Jesus and is somehow complaining about the dividing of the family inheritance. And it's difficult to know exactly what the situation here is, because I think the practice was to give everything to the eldest son. So I don't know whether he's saying that's not fair and let's not keep the custom because the custom is unjust, or whether the brother has, or the inheritance has violated what's customary and he's complaining about that. That much is not clear. But what is clear, it's an issue of justice in the mind of the, well, ostensibly, he's appealing to justice. He wants Jesus to arbitrate, to be a judge over this matter. And it just struck me, there are plenty of Christians and Christian communities and Christian traditions out there who would argue, basically, that the very focus of Christian discipleship is that we have been taught by our teacher Jesus to want justice in this world, and that in order to be a disciple in good standing, in order to be a bona fide disciple of Jesus, I am going to work toward bringing about justice in society and justice in our world and in our culture. Well, this is a really awkward passage. If that's your model of discipleship, it seems to me this is a really awkward passage, because here's our teacher confronted with one single case of accomplishing justice in the world. I mean, all the guy is doing is saying, you be the judge, you arbitrate here, you be the mediator between me and my brother. I just want justice. I may be reading that into it. Jesus thinks that he wants more than justice or something other than justice, but I would imagine that his appeal is on the ground of, I want you to be the judge here in this situation. And Jesus' response is, no, not going to do that. Who appointed me? I'm not your mediator. I'm not the arbitrator. And I think what I hear him saying is, that's not why I came to the earth. Now, if I'm right about that, that's huge, because it really flies in the face of one very, very strong, compelling model for discipleship that a lot of Christians have, is that the most important thing in the world is that we follow the example of Jesus, who is committed to justice, and we need to establish justice in this world. And so discipleship consists in our promoting and working toward social justice. Well, then it occurred to me, what are the other models of discipleship that we have? I mean, that's one, that what I eventually call the social justice model. Are there other models of justice that become kind of the lenses through which we think about our faith, look at our Christianity, read the Bible, and so on? Are there others? And I, I came up with what I think are 12 different models, all of which I have been influenced by at one time or another in my life. Well, all but one, maybe. All but one of them I've been influenced at one time or another in my life. And what I want to contend here this morning, here's the case I want to make, or here's the assertion that I want to make. I don't know if I'm making a case, but here's what I want to assert. Of these 12 different models, I would argue that only one of them is the biblical model. It's number 12. If you don't like the label, give it another one. I don't mind. But I think number 12, what I call the existential model, is really the only truly New Testament biblical model. All of these others are one way or another eccentric. They're off-center. They don't quite capture what our faith is really all about. However, having said that, all of them are current in Christian culture today. And it's not like we divide up neatly into categories. You know, I'm a legalist, I'm a Puritan, I'm a servant, I'm for social justice. The fact of the matter is most of us touch down at one point or another in our life on all of these models. It's like we just sort of float above the morass of these different pictures of what our Christianity is. And depending upon who the speaker is or what the seminar is or what book I'm reading or what influence has my ear at the moment, we're compelled by the particular model or particular picture that speaker or author is presenting. And because we're not grounded ourselves, it just makes sense to us, sounds good to us. At least that's my experience. I just remember from college on, going to hearing one speaker at the college youth group who's compelling me to be this kind of disciple, and then the next weekend I'd hear another speaker compelling me to be this kind of disciple. I didn't think of it in those terms. I mean, you end up thinking you're supposed to do all of it, even though it's probably physically and even logically impossible to be all of those at the same time. But they all sounded good. They all sounded right. So my assertion, my exhortation this morning is, I really do think it's incumbent upon us as believers to get nailed down. What exactly is the picture, the model, the paradigm of Christian discipleship that is taught by the Bible? I'm arguing it's number 12. But in any case, if I'm wrong about that, there's no question but what, in order for me to be grounded, I need to decide which of these is right and which of these are wrong. And to stop being unduly swayed by all those voices and all those arguments and all those perspectives that come our way through the drift of Christian culture, telling us to be this, do that, think this way, think that way. And we're just jumping all over the place like popcorn being popped. So that's what I want to accomplish this morning. So let's look at these 12 different models. The first one is the one that I was taught to immediately reject and has never been one that I've been influenced by. I call it the membership model. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to engaging in those religious practices that my Christian culture deems to be essential for me to be counted as a member in good standing of the body of Christ and thereby to be qualified for eternal life. This is the one I think that is probably pretty standard among a lot of Roman Catholics, probably among a lot of Orthodox Christians, Eastern Orthodox Christians. This is probably being pretty standard among some Lutherans and Episcopalians. Any church that has been a state church anywhere, this is probably pretty typical, where your whole conception of what it means to be a Christian is to simply go to Mass, do the sacraments, do the worship services a respectable number of times, do whatever it takes that within that culture and within that society would qualify you as a member in good standing. And the logic of the model seems to be that it's inclusion in a group that is the basis of your salvation. As long as you belong to the group, it's the group that's going to be saved. It's the group that's going to be given eternal life. So as long as you qualify for that group, then you're okay. Now, probably most of these other models would reject that out of hand. Those are only nominal Christians. Those are only cultural Christians. So they're not real Christians. But it's a very real model out there, because there are probably more people in the world that are thinking of their Christianity by that model than any of the other models. But I think it's wrong. I don't think the Bible ever supports the idea that we are disciples by virtue of the group we belong to. If any group would be the right group, you'd think it would be the Jews. And Paul's whole perspective in the book of Romans is that even though God has chosen the Jews, that doesn't necessarily mean he's chosen individual Jews. To have chosen a group as a group does not select every individual in the group. There's another criteria that determines whether any given individual is rightly related to God and a child of God or not. And he argues it's faith in Jesus. So being a Jew in and of itself doesn't qualify you, he argues. Well, the same thing is certainly true in Christianity. It's not being a Christian that makes you a child of God. It's being a Christian who actually has faith in Jesus. That's what makes you a child of God. And being a Christian can't possibly be enough. We've already seen in the passage in Luke coming up to this, his emphasis on inwardness. Discipleship cannot ultimately be defined by cultural or religious practices of any kind, because Jesus is insisting to the disciples, it's not what's on the outside of the plate, it's what's inside. And anything short of meeting the condition of inwardness that makes you a child of God can't possibly give you eternal life. So that's a relatively easy model, I think, to dismiss. The second one is this, what I call the service model. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to serving God in whatever way he has called me to serve him. And that could be anything from evangelism to serving the church in concrete, practical, palpable ways, to meeting the physical or emotional or intellectual needs of others, and so on. When I was a child, many missionaries came through making the appeal, you need to be a missionary. And I, whether they said this or not, I don't know. But a lot of things in churches get said between the lines, and you certainly get a picture, even if it never gets stated explicitly, that if you're going to be a real Christian, if you're going to be a real disciple of Jesus and not sit here in America and live a comfortable life with all of your wealth and all of your leisure and all of your fun pursuits, if you're going to be a real Christian who's willing to give everything for Jesus, then of course you would go and be a missionary. That seems to have been the model of the faith that drove Mother Teresa, for example. Many traditions emphasize social justice, hunger, and poverty fighting, you know, work against hunger and poverty in the world, some World Vision and Bread for the World and or whatever those organizations are that might come in if they were to speak here. You might very well get the impression that there's something remiss in your relationship with God if you're not doing your part to wipe out hunger and poverty in the world. Well, where's that coming from? I think it's coming from this model that says that's what discipleship is. If you're not doing something, anywhere from winning souls and evangelism or in the mission field to doing something to change the world socially and politically, any way that you're sacrificing your life for that, if you're not doing that, then you're not a real disciple. Now, there's no question but what that kind of activity, that kind of action, is valuable, and no question that it's even necessary to have a loving concern for the physical needs of others and a loving concern for the spiritual needs of others. There's no question that that's an element or an aspect of discipleship. Certainly that's true. The problem is that one can be lovingly concerned for the physical needs of others without even beginning to qualify in the first degree to be a disciple of Jesus. Because you don't need that inwardness that Jesus has been talking about. All you need is a little humanity. All you need is to be born a human being made in the image of God, to not be compelled by the need to be compassionate to other people and to express that compassion in the way that you live your life. That does not make you a disciple of Jesus. It just makes you a bona fide human being, which isn't nothing. You know, that's important. But it's not enough to make you a disciple. And the same with evangelism. Anybody can be motivated and compelled to be an evangelist and to actively pursue evangelism without genuinely having a loving concern for other people. I mean, it can be a competition. It can be a game. It can be a source of prestige and status in certain culture and certain community. If that's what's motivating us, then that's not a part of being a disciple. To whatever extent we are disciples, it's going to be truly a loving concern that's going to be motivating it. And again, we've seen the emphasis on inwardness. So discipleship can't ultimately be defined by my external and outward service of God of any kind. It's ultimately going to be defined by this thing that I'm calling inwardness. The legalistic model, it's the one that Jesus has been interacting with throughout this passage, and the Pharisees, the legalism of the Pharisees. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to bringing my outward actions and inward attitudes into conformity to a set of moral values and religious practices that God endorses, even though I don't, in order to gain the reward that God will grant to those who do so. The fundamental characteristic of legalism is that which I am doing to serve God, that which I am doing to obey God, is not something that spontaneously belongs to me on the insides. I'm doing it for God. I mean, we would never quite put it quite this explicitly or this baldly, but I just remember my childhood. The distinct impression I got in the church was, here we need to go out and do this for God. We need to obey God. You know, we need to pray X amount. We need to read the Bible a certain amount. We need to love our neighbors, ourselves, and so on. And none of that was interesting to me. There wasn't a single bit of it that was interesting to me. But, you know, God's into that. So because he's into that, that's what he wants me to give to him and to do for him. Well, sanctification that the New Testament talks about is my insides being so transformed that what God wants, I begin to want spontaneously. Those become my desires. So I'm not acting out of what Paul calls the letter of the law. I'm not acting in obedience to law because the law says so. Rather, it's by the Spirit. I'm acting out of obedience to the law because I want to, because the Spirit of God has transformed my spirit to make the demands of the law my own passions, my own desires, my own yearnings, my own self-defining pursuits. Pharisaism, that's exactly what Jesus saw as the problem with Phariseeism. There are many forms of Christian Phariseeism throughout history, and this model just gets put in our face over and over and over and over again. So I won't talk any more about that because we've been talking about that for weeks. The next one is the purification model. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to the task of self-transformation, to the task of transcending my innate wickedness and purifying myself, making myself into an authentically good person. So in this model, this becomes the pursuit of the disciple. I'm going to do whatever it takes to make myself a better person. And the way I've articulated it here, I'm literally making myself a gooder person. I mean, I'm actually transcending my wickedness itself. I'm rising above my wickedness. There's another model that I could have included that I think is not naive about the depth of my own wickedness, recognizes that I can't become good, but believes that I can become holy. And so you might call that the holiness model, that what I'm pursuing is the kind of self-transformation of my heart, of my spirit, of my commitments, such that I transcend my rebellion against God and I replace my rebellion against God with a genuine love for God, a genuine holiness. That's another version of this that's a little bit more realistic, and I'll talk about both of them together here. mostly people don't make the distinction, and so the two get blurred. The two models get blurred. Mostly Christians don't make a distinction between becoming holy and becoming good. We pretty much think it's the same thing. Luther was tortured by this pursuit, if you remember. You know, he, after his event of being struck by lightning or the near miss of lightning or whatever happened, and he decides to stop his pursuit of studying law and to go into the monastery and to become an Augustinian monk. The rest of his life, up until the time of the Reformation, until his insight into justification by faith, was spent trying to purify himself, to rid himself of the evil that was all too evident and all too apparent within him. That seemed to be the thing that drove the whole monastic movement in the Middle Ages. Today, it seems to drive what is virtually a fad within evangelicalism today, a return to the medieval spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices. What do we call it? Spiritual formation. There are classes and seminaries these days on spiritual formation. It's out of this sort of model, that is, what is it that we need to do as disciples of Jesus? What do we need to practice? What do we need to do in order to go to work on ourselves and make ourselves different than we are? Either make ourselves good and to replace the wickedness with good, or make ourselves holy and replace our rebellion against God with holiness. It's very compelling. I mean, if you were to have a speaker come in here and speak on spiritual formation, you'd go away, probably most of us would go here away from here going, yeah, I need to get to work on that. I haven't been a serious disciple of Jesus because I haven't been practicing what I need to practice, doing what I need to do, engaging the spiritual discipline that I need to engage in order to go to work on myself to make me no longer lacking in holiness and lacking in goodness. And we'd probably respond quite favorably to that, feel guilty, feel convicted, feel inspired, feel encouraged for a week or two. The problem is, let's take the purification model, pure and simple, it's naive, it's unrealistic, it's out of touch with the reality of who we are, and it, as such, it's downright unbelieving, frankly. It doesn't believe what Jesus taught us. Because as we've seen in these passages leading up to this one, Jesus teaches the impossibility of us sinners being or achieving true goodness. That's out of reach to us. My whole being is wrong, and my whole being always will be wrong until God fixes it. And that's my hope. That's my inheritance in the life to come, in the age to come, is that God is finally going to fix me. But until he fixes me, everything about me is wrong. And there's no amount of spiritual discipline that's going to change that. As the proverb says, can the leopard change his spots? Can the black Ethiopian change the color of his skin? Can a wicked sinner whose very being is completely wrong to the core change? Be other than that? No. It's entirely out of reach. So under this model, if I really take this model seriously, I either need to resort to self-delusion and say that I'm good when I'm not, count as good things that God would not count as good, or I'm crushed, literally crushed by the pursuit, one or the other. Now, take the other model, the holiness model. That's not quite as unrealistic because holiness is within reach to us as believers. We are going to become holy. We are going to become mature. We are going to become, as the New Testament, as the apostles call it, teleos in this world. People whose lives, we are going to become new creatures, as Paul puts it in one of the Corinthian letters. So that's not naive in the same sort of way, but it doesn't understand holiness, and it doesn't understand the nature of holiness. Because I would argue that from a biblical perspective, there's no way you can change the commitments of your heart by working from the outside in. No amount of prayer, no amount of fasting, no amount of meditation, no amount of silence, no amount of anything that you might practice on the outside of your body is going to resolve in your heart how you want to define your existence. The only way to change yourself on the inside is to go inside and decide deep down within the depths of your being, what do I want? Who do I want to be? And nothing, when you find yourself powerless to want to be the right sort of person, there's only one recourse for us. God, have mercy on me. God, change me. God, you make me. You renew me. Because I can't do it. I'm not interested in being one who loves you and knows you. But I will want to be one who wants to love you and know you. So change me. But there's no amount of external pressure that we're going to put on ourselves that's going to bring that to pass. That's not to say that we don't make those inner decisions in the midst of some of those practices. But it's an illusion. Because it wasn't the practice that made me make the change. It was me that made me make the change as prompted supernaturally, miraculously by the Spirit of God. It's the Spirit of God who did it, not the spiritual discipline or the religious practice. Okay, the next model I call the success model. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to achieving the success, the prosperity, and the happiness that every human being desires by living in conformity to the divine principles that guarantee such success. This is wildly popular. This is present everywhere in Christian culture, and there's a wide variety of different forms it takes. On the one hand, the prosperity gospel, you know, come to Jesus and do it right, that which is to say, tithe to me, and you will prosper mightily. That's one extreme. There's the view that I held and taught aggressively for years, what I now call Star Wars theology or Christian Taoism, what historians call Keswick theology, the victorious Christian life theology, that if you just learn the key to living the Christian life, of walking by faith, of walking by the Spirit, if you just learn the key to do that, then your whole life is going to be transformed. You'll become an effective evangelist. You'll become a loving and moral and good person. You'll become a wise husband or wife or parent. There just isn't anything that won't go right if you will just learn the key to living by the Spirit and walking by the Spirit. Very attractive, very compelling model and very compelling picture. And in this view, then, the discipleship is focused on learning the keys, learning the secrets, learning the principles that Jesus came into the world to teach us in order that we might be successful. One thing that always bothered me in my teaching when I was teaching this is, what's the cross have to do with it? I never understood that. I mean, I always had an answer. Well, there were all those past sins that needed to be forgiven. So that's what that was all about. But the whole focus of everything was not Jesus' death on the cross, but Jesus coming into the world to teach us the keys to living successfully, the principles to living successfully. Well, a good book could have done that, as all of our bookstores attest. Most of the seminars that we as Christians invent and subject ourselves to are based on this sort of model. Most of the books that we read in Christian culture are based on this model. What are the principles for being a godly and successful businessman? What are the principles for being a godly and wise and effective parent? What are the principles for having a godly and biblical marriage? What are the principles? Notice the word principles keeps coming up, because it's out of this model that says all we really need are to understand the way the universe works as God put it, and it's the Bible that gives us the laws of the universe. We just need to learn those laws and rules and live by those, and then we will be successful. It's actually very reminiscent of ancient Stoicism in that regard. It's not really Christian at all. What's the problem with that model, besides being false? It misunderstands what's valuable and important. I mean, it appeals to our worldliness. What we're really focused on is success in the here and now. I don't want any failure. I don't want any hardship in my marriage. I don't want any difficulties with my children. I don't want any difficulties in my business. I don't want any difficulties in life at all. And this model is promising you that if you do it right, you will avoid any adversity and any difficulties. Well, that's a very worldly kind of attitude, because the whole nature of Christian discipleship is God coming into my life with any number of adversity, tragedy, disappointment, unmet expectations of one kind or another, and God saying, what do you want more? To have your expectations met and your dreams fulfilled, or to serve me? Which do you want more? And discipleship is making that crisis decision. Do I want my life defined by my relationship with God, my love of God, my obedience to God, or do I want life to go well? Which do I want? And I think I can fairly say God never gives you both. That's not an option. He's not going to give you both. You're going to have to make a choice. That's discipleship, is making that choice. It misunderstands the nature of Jesus' teaching. Jesus did not come to teach us how to live successfully. Jesus came into this world of losers that we are and announced the good news. God is going to bless us anyway, even though we are losers, if we want to receive it. And that's what he came to teach us, not to teach us the secret to success. Okay, the next one I call the social justice model. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to the task of transforming the world, to the task of bringing God's righteousness into the world to eliminate its many and varied evils. There's the political left version of this, and there's the political right version of this, and they're both making exactly the same mistake, I would argue. On the one hand, on the right, you have anti-abortion efforts, anti-gay marriage devotees, whatever the social evil that is current today that we are intent on eliminating from our culture. Or on the other, on the left, you have anti-war, anti-poverty, anti-capitalism devotees. I mean, we just need to get rid of all these social and all these unjust, wicked things in the world. And then there's anything in between. Well, that's what prompted this whole thing this morning, is that Jesus seems in this passage that we're just looking at to reject that model. I haven't come to bring justice. You know, man, I haven't come to make sure that life is just for you. And while we're at it, you're greedy. While you're at it, let's get to the real problem in your life. It's not the injustice in your experience. It's the greed in your heart that is the problem I came into the world to take care of. It's a very, very different model. So this model misunderstands the nature of God's purposes. God is not intent on fixing this broken world that is sunk in darkness as it is. That doesn't seem to be his agenda. He never said it was. He's never acted like that's his agenda. There's really no reason to think that's his agenda. His purpose, rather, as he himself says on a number of occasions, as Jesus teaches, is to invade this domain of darkness and transfer some of us, the ones he's chosen, to the domain of light, the kingdom of his Son, is to literally steal us away from this broken, darkened world and move us out of here into the kingdom of light. Now, I don't mean physically remove us, but existentially, in our inwardness, to take our inwardness so that it's no longer a part of the kingdom of darkness and to make it a part of the kingdom of light instead. So to be in sync with God's purposes is not to set my sights on cultural transformation, on social justice, or on eliminating evil in the world, no matter what evil you point to. It's to set my sights on all of us understanding and being persuaded to accept the mercy of God that's proclaimed in the gospel. That's God's purpose. And to be his disciple, it seems to me that needs to be the focus of my purpose. Another model, the next model, is what I've called the mystical model. And again, I mean this rather broadly. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to the pursuit of repeated experiences of God. And those experiences can be identified in different ways. Experience of his love, experience of his comfort, experience of his greatness, experience of his purity, or even experience of his wrath. But I'm pursuing repeated experiences of that in order that I might feel the joy, the guilt, or whatever emotion most signifies most truly that I am in contact with ultimate reality. I mean, that's the only way I can understand. You know, when I was a child, there was a whole tradition. There were churches that would have an altar call every week, and the sermon, you know, that leading up to the altar call was just bashing people to pieces with how damnable and guilty and condemned they were. I mean, the pastor was being a catalyst to making them feel the wrath of God. And people would go back week after week after week after week to feel the wrath of God against them, to feel their guilt, to feel their condemnation. But I think in a strange kind of way, that's attractive. Because if you think that's ultimate reality, at least now you have an emotional connection with that which is ultimate reality. And I think that's what all these emphases on experience have in common, and that's why they're attractive, is that what we tell ourselves is this feeling that I'm feeling is me in touch with God. It's me in the presence of God. He's no longer removed. He's no longer distant. He's no longer abstract. I can feel his presence. Even if it's negative, even if it's condemnation, at least I'm feeling his presence. We tend to prefer the love and comfort part, but nonetheless, both will do the job. Medieval mysticism, I think, is very much motivated by this and in this model. I think another thing that's become faddish in Christian culture today is this incredible emphasis on worship that we see in Christian culture today. And again, I think it's fueled by this model. People come to church to have the experience. And why is the experience valuable to them? The experience is valuable to them because they feel like they have met God somehow, in some way. Have they really met God? Well, if you really meet God, when you leave, you're changed. You're transformed. You don't meet God and stay the same. So I don't think you really are meeting God in these experiences. Some of you have heard me tell this before, but the greatest worship experience I ever had in my life was at a Peter, Paul, and Mary concert. And I don't think the Holy Spirit was within 50 miles of there. But it was just the aesthetic experience that I had was a wonderful aesthetic experience. And it was inspiring. It was ennobling. I felt like I wanted to go out of there and be a good person. But I don't think anything... I mean, I may be wrong. It may be that the Spirit decided to meet me at that point in that concert. That's possible. But it's also possible that nothing substantial of eternal worth happened that night. Well, the same is often true in our Christian worship services. We may have a profound aesthetic experience. And that's nice. That's wonderful. And I'm not diminishing that in any way. That's a part of our humanity. And it can be a really wonderful experience. But it's not the same thing as being met by God. It's not the same thing. When God meets us, he makes us into new creatures. So I think the problem with this model is that it just completely misunderstands the nature of spirituality. It misunderstands the work of the Holy Spirit and what the Holy Spirit is intent on doing. It mistakes spirituality with emotionality and sort of blurs the distinction and makes them identical to one another. The next model is the cultural transformation model. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to doing that which I have personally been called to do, to redeem and transform the ethnic or national culture I am a part of, making its institutions and practices conform to the tenets of a Christian worldview. There are whole traditions built on this model. I can't remember what it's called in Calvinistic circles, theonomy movement, I think, sees this as part and parcel of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, is to somehow bring the law of God to bear on American culture and so transform American culture that it is now a nation informed by, enlightened by, and obedient to the law of God. Oftentimes, this model is, the slogan that you see in this model is that Jesus is Lord of every area of life. There's not a single area of life, a single sphere that God is not the Lord of. And that this thinking actually came out of Dutch Calvinism, largely. Now, is that true? Yeah, that's true. But the fact that Jesus is Lord of every area of life, does it necessarily follow that Jesus' intent and God's intent is to redeem and transform every area of life and every area of our culture, here and now in history in this world? Comes back to what I was talking about earlier. I don't think that's God's agenda. His agenda is to snatch us away from this world, not to redeem this world. If you read Chuck Colson's book, How Now Shall We Live? Yeah. How Now Shall We Live, or How Shall We Now Live? How Now Brown Cow? That there is a very clear, this model was very clearly coming through in that book. Those of you who heard Nancy Piercy a couple years ago, that emphasis was coming through in hers. Francis Schaeffer had that emphasis to a certain extent, and that came through in his film series. That film series. I always just felt so guilty, when I was confronted by those models, because it's very compelling. You want to take it on. Yeah, I want to go out there and transform and redeem the culture. I want to redeem philosophy for Jesus. I want to become that philosopher who brings Jesus back into philosophy and vanquishes all those atheistic Marxist foes, and make philosophy captive to Jesus. It's very compelling, very attractive. But it's not going to happen if Jesus is not interested in philosophy, the philosophy of this world. If he's not interested in making that an academic discipline that honors him and glorifies him in the world, maybe rather he's in the end going to destroy worldly philosophy with the breath of his mouth. Maybe that's what he's going to do instead. And in the meantime, all we can do here and now is proclaim the good news about how he's coming to mercifully take us out of here. I mean, there's all kinds of mean, nasty names for people like me who are proclaiming this sort of model, but I think it's the biblical model. The counterculture model is very closely related to the cultural transformation model. It's just that the counterculture model doesn't see us as transforming American culture. It sees us as setting up a counterculture over and against American culture to convict, to condemn, to challenge and rebuke, to be a prophetic rebuke of the ungodly American culture around us. So as a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to doing that which I have personally been called to do, to promote and contribute to the establishment of a counterculture that is faithfully Christian. And you have two versions of that. You have kind of the mainstream American Christian counterculture, and then you have a much more truly intentional community kind of counterculture that other Christian groups that are not in the mainstream would propose as the counterculture of choice. But they're in agreement that what we're doing is setting up a counterculture. So the whole emphasis on the mainstream, the whole emphasis on Christian music. Let's have a whole Christian music industry that's a counterculture to that evil rock and roll industry. The whole original impetus, we probably have lost sight of this, but I remember the original impetus behind the megachurch movement was that our churches, because I remember the youth pastor when I was in high school, was actually attracted to this whole thinking that what churches need to do is not simply be churches that people go out in their community and live their lives and then come and touch and, you know, brush past the church for an hour or two every Sunday morning. The church needs to be your life. The church needs to be the community of Christians. So we need to have a roller skate and a roller skating rink and a bowling alley and a pizza parlor as just part of our churches. So if people want pizzas, they go to church to get pizzas. If people want to go bowling, they go to church to go bowling. If they want to go roller skating, they go to church to go roller skating. So they're always with, around, and associating with other Christians in all of their social activities. That was the original emphasis in the megachurch movement. Anytime churches emphasize social events as the, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with social events, but to the exclusion of everything else, it's because they're trying to create a community that's a counterculture to the world around. Sometimes the emphasis on Christian art can be motivated by this model. We need to set up a whole different counterculture, and art will be the language that that defines that. But this will now be Christian art, not non-Christian art. Again, I think this model misunderstands the nature of God's purposes. It's not to fix this broken world. So it's not to set up a counterculture to be a prophetic challenge to it either. It's something different. The next model is the ideological model. I was very attracted to this in college. I mean, this is basically how I understood my faith in college. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to the pursuit of understanding the Christian worldview and the philosophy of the Bible in order that I might achieve ideological purity and promote it among other Christians. So, very intellectualistic. I was a Christian like most of the Marxists I knew were Marxists. That is, you wanted to know what is true Marxism. What is orthodox Marxism? What is a pure form of Marxism? And then we want to understand it, and we want to promote it, and we want to propagate it, and we want to implement that pure form of Marxism in the world. Well, as a counterpart to that, I saw myself as a Christian, as being Christianity was an ideology. It was a set of ideas. It was a way of thinking about life. It was a way of thinking about the world. And so we needed to as best we could understand that ideology that is Christianity in a pure form, in an orthodox form, in a form that's not tainted by alien ideas, and then promote that and implement that in the world. I know what was driving me. It was a lust for intellectual respectability. That's what was tempting me. And I fear all too often when people gravitate to this model, that's what they really are interested in. I want to make Christianity respectable by making it an intellectual ideology that I embrace. And it's just as valid and just as good and certainly just as respectable as anything you can offer me as an ideology. But it's overly intellectualistic, so it misses the whole point. It makes Christianity the province of intellectuals and eggheads, not the province of ordinary human beings. And that can't be right. There's no way that that's right. It misunderstands the nature of God's purposes. God's purpose in my life is not to make me intellectually sophisticated. Rather, God's purpose in my life is to make me wise. And wisdom is very, very different than intellectual sophistication. Some of the wisest people I know are very unsophisticated, are very simple people, academically, intellectually speaking, but they are incredibly and deeply wise people. And that's what God wants from us, is that wisdom. Yeah. The next model is sort of parallels the last model in a way, but it's distinctly different. The intellectual, or you might even call it the Gnostic model. As a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to the pursuit of understanding the truth, that is, the objective truth about God and reality. Now, I'm going to argue that this is close to being true. I think this is close to true, but It's what's lacking. It's what's missing in my definition that is fatal to it. Because it is only intellectual in its cast. Unlike the etiological model, the truth here is defined usually by divine revelation rather than by the etiology of the Judeo-Christian worldview. I'm not trying to understand the Judeo-Christian worldview. I'm trying to understand the truth as it's revealed in the Bible. So more conservative Bible-believing people are going to be attracted to this model. The other model is more ecumenical. Right? A lot of different people under the name of Christianity can be attracted to that. But this is for, you know, Bible thumpers. You know. So to be a discipleship then is to be a devoted Bible student who just knows the Bible inside and out and lets everybody know it by telling you the reference to every verse that you quote. It's being devoted to sound exegesis. I hope you know by now I believe in sound exegesis. I believe sound exegesis is extremely important. But if you define your discipleship by that, you've missed the point. Being devoted to theology and knowing theology really well is often motivated by this model, theology and doctrine. It's not usually preoccupied with intellectual respectability, because how can you be intellectually respectable and believe in the Bible? I mean, that's a lost cause anyway. So it's not preoccupied with intellectual respectability, but it is preoccupied with doctrinal purity and therefore a kind of spiritual respectability in certain subcultures. Again, this misunderstands the nature of God's purposes. God's purpose in my life is not to make me theologically sophisticated and knowledgeable. It's to make me wise. And if my study of the truth in the Bible is not a means to me becoming wise, then it's totally fruitless and beside the point. And it's not what I'm wanting to learn from Jesus as his student, as a disciple of Jesus. This, too, is overly intellectualistic, therefore. And this one typically appeals to the glory that comes from knowledge rather than the glory that comes from intellectual sophistication. It's the one verse that I quote out of the King James and never any other translation, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians, knowledge puffeth up. Then finally, we come to the model that I think is the right one, what I'm calling the existential model. Call it what you will. You don't need to use that label. But as a disciple of Jesus, I have devoted my life to coming to understand the truth, that is, the objective truth about God and reality, just like the last model, the intellectual model. Because following my teacher Jesus, I have made a personal commitment to make living in the light of that truth the defining reality of my existence. And it's that piece that makes bona fide discipleship real discipleship. But notice that the way there is clearly understood to be through the door, through the gateway of understanding. Not through worship, not through service, not through spiritual and religious disciplines, not through any of the other things that are advocated by these other models, but through understanding. It's by understanding the truth that I have the resources to ask myself the right kinds of questions that I can inwardly, in the inner depths of my being, resolve in just the right sort of way to make me into a person who loves God and wants to serve him. Now, without that resolve, without that commitment deep inside, all my understanding is worthless, means nothing. But it's that understanding that raises the appropriate questions and offers the appropriate answers that I need to decide whether I'm going to embrace and whether I'm going to believe. I think we need to become grounded in that model and only that model, not be those kinds of Christians that float above all of these and touch down whenever we want to, on whatever model we want to at the time. I embrace them all sequentially at various times. But we have to become convinced that this is what Jesus wants from us, to understand his truth, the truth that he came into the world to teach us. And that truth is largely centered on what he calls the gospel, the good news, that God is going to be merciful to us and grant us the ultimate blessing, even though we don't deserve it. So what will that look like? What do I think that should look like? Three things. One, I think we will, as disciples of Jesus, pursue the truth of the Bible, pursue an understanding of the truth of the Bible in whatever way makes sense for us personally. For me, given how God has wired me, given my background, given my experience, I mean, just everything about me makes that be original exegesis of the original languages of the Bible, and to understand it as thoroughly and as accurately as I can. I mean, that's what it looks like for me. So it's going to be pretty academic in my life, and in a good sense, not a bad sense. It's going to be academic in that I'm going to use the academic tools that I have acquired over the course of my life to try to get at the meaning of the Scriptures. So that's what it's going to look like for me. But it would be a mistake for me to say, therefore, that's what it has to look like for you. You know, you have to be like me in order to be taking the Bible seriously. I don't think that's true. Many of you take the Bible and what it teaches with utter seriousness in your station in life, in your condition, in the circumstances in which God has put you. You hunger to know what the Bible teaches. And by lending me your ear at times, oftentimes what's motivating you is that you trust me, Ron, David, the other people who teach here. You trust us enough that you think it's worth listening to what we have to say in order to get at what it is that the Bible teaches. That's fine. If that's all you do, that's fine, as long as you pursue that through teachers that you trust, and even if you trust them, that you always listen carefully and critically. You know, I may be experienced, but I'm also a human being. And one of the things I've learned in my study of the Bible is because I'm a human being, I can be selfish, proud, stubborn, intractable. Need I go on? And all of that stuff can distort and can... can make me go off on some, can make me become eccentric in what I'm teaching, in what I'm seeing, in what I'm understanding the Bible to be saying. So you always need to be thinking critically. Is this commonsensical, rational, objective reading of the text that Jack has given me? Or is this some weird, strange hobby horse that he's on right now? And you ultimately have to decide that. I won't be able to decide it. I'm too close to it. You know, I'm stuck. But you need to decide that. And if you want to point it out to me, that'd be kind too. Ideally, one day I want to talk about, just take some time to talk about what would strike me as an ideal Christian community. Because it seems to me it's never been achieved in my experience. That of all communities, the kind of community that's made up of genuine, bona fide disciples of Jesus is going to be a community that's in dialogue and conversation, where we're disagreeing with one another and we're arguing with one another and we're contending with one another because we want to know what the truth is. And so I need to test my understanding of the truth against your understanding of the truth. But we can do it respectfully and lovingly and without a church split and without warfare within our midst, because we know that nothing is at stake. I don't have to arrive at the truth to be saved. I have to arrive at the truth to know the truth. But I'm going to be saved in spite of the fact that I have some crazy ideas, in spite of the fact that I'm not quite there, that I don't really get it. So nothing's at stake. We can have the courage and the humility and the mutual respect for one another and love for one another to be able to disagree with one another. That would be an ideal Christian community, it seems to me. And I would love for us to more and more, in our particular context, to move in that direction. But however it looks for you, personal Bible study and exegesis in the Greek text, guided personal Bible study in the English text, or just listening to teachers that you trust, the thing that's not optional, though, is to not be seeking the understanding that's contained in the Bible. And I do put it that way, the understanding that's contained in the Bible as opposed to the Bible itself, because that's what we want. We want the content of its message, not necessarily the... If you have the content of its message, you don't need to know how to outline the books of the Bible and how to rightly exegete every verse in the Bible and so on. You know, that's my pursuit. But that doesn't have to be a disciple's pursuit. What we want is the content of the Bible. We want to understand that. What is its message? The second thing I think we need to do is stay awake. You know, that's the constant exhortation of the apostles. Stay awake. Don't go to sleep. We need to soberly face into the stakes here. This is not a game. This is a life or death issue. It's those who are embracing the truth who will be saved. So we need to stay awake to the in the face of all those forces out there that are going to numb us and put us to sleep and make us shift our focus and focus on other distractions in the world instead of staying focused on what is my existence all about. Let me go to the Bible and learn what my existence is all about. So that with courage and humility, we confront the truth that we learn from the Bible and internalize what we hear, making it the inner commitments of our heart. We have to have that kind of resolve. It's not just intellectual. I need to internalize it. And then therefore what would follow from that is that we then live our entire life in the light of that truth that we've internalized, having understood it from the Bible. That's not going to look exactly the same for each and every individual. God has us on different journeys. We have different callings. Some of us may be Mother Teresa's and devote our life to reaching out to people in physical need and meeting their physical needs. Some of us may be evangelists and missionaries. Some of us may work toward trying to eliminate some social injustice in the world. It's not that those are bad things to do, and we may very well be called to do some of those things as individuals, but it's not our discipleship. It's not the task that we're taking on as students of Jesus. As students of Jesus, the task I'm taking on is to understand God and to understand myself and to understand the world and my relationship to it, and then to live my life in its entirety in the light of that truth. Okay, we have a few minutes here.
Okay, wow, I really appreciate what you have to say. I think you're a very thoughtful, ingenious person, actually. Not that that should come as a surprise or anything. Anyway, I'm thinking, okay, as I read through the Bible, you know, and I've done this at this church. I've come here and I've relied on you guys who are really intellectually strong and know different languages that the Bible's written in and stuff. And I've thought, oh, okay, these guys know more than I do. Well, I've kind of had to work my way back around that and get through it and stuff. But then I go, okay, well, now if I'm going to go back and read my Bible on my own, which, you know, I should be doing anyway, but I'm confessing that in front of everybody, I go, well, you guys, here it is, us, them, seem to have this ability to take this sting out of the scriptures and to be able to read it and go, you know, this is what Jesus is really saying. Well, then it seems like I, you know, when I go and I read the Bible most of the time, I'm not able to do that. So I'm saying, well, here's Jesus saying, you know, if you're a tree and you don't bear good fruit, you're going to get the axe. Well, gosh, that tells me you better get your stuff together. You don't want to get the axe, you know. And so I go, well, okay.
You seem to have understood it very well.
well, like, how do we how do we do what you guys do?
Well, it's not nearly as magical and mysterious as it may seem. I mean, I remember.
It better not take Latin, you know.
Sorry?
It better not take Latin to do this.
No. I really do think that we have been remiss at not providing more opportunities for all of you to develop your skills. But it takes a lot of time and a lot of work. I mean, and that's what we Americans don't have a lot of typically. And so that is a big, huge problem. It's not, I know you're capable of doing it. It's just, it's a matter of, like any skill, you need to practice it. You need to do it and do it and do it again and learn how to do it by doing it. And that's what we typically haven't taken the time to do. And even if we've tried to study the Bible, it's been completely on our own without any kind of coaching and guidance and feedback that allows me to develop the skill. And so if you're like me, when I was young, I would try to study the Bible, and I'd last a week, and then I'd go, it's too hard. I mean, I give up. I'll never be able to do this. And frankly, I don't know how God brought me through that barrier, you know, over that obstacle actually, I do know how he did it. You know, for me, it was in one aha experience. I was at a workshop that university was putting on, and I don't know if they still do it, but they used to have a lot of inductive kind of studies where you sit around and study. And in this case, it was a parable. We had taken on a parable of Jesus, so it was a nice bite-sized chunk. And I realized in the midst of that workshop, and we were just all sharing our ideas, but all of a sudden a light went on. And I just understood all of a sudden what Jesus was doing in that parable. And no one else agreed in the group. But that didn't really matter because I knew that I had gotten it. You know, it just made way too much sense that's what he was doing for it not to be the case. And so that was the breakthrough for me, because I walked away from that weekend going, I can do this. This is not out of reach. This is something that I can do. And that kind of started me in the process of taking on the task of studying the Bible. But that's what you need, is the confidence to get built by having the experience of studying the Bible, where you have that kind of aha experience where it all falls together for you. Because that's the way it works, is that, I mean, the reason you know you don't get it is because you're just as confused after 3 hours of studying as you were before 3 hours of studying. Then you walk away from there going, what's the point? You just need to be able to break through once and have it all fall in place and see that the clues were pointing in a particular direction and that you got it. And then you'll gain the confidence that I can do this. But I think we need to do something to create the kind of experiences where people can practice and develop that skill. Because you can do it. It's not as mysterious as it might seem.
Thanks.
Hey there.
I thought your talk was absolutely wonderful. I want to make an observation about this, and you tell me what you think of that. What I realize is that what struck me is that 12 really isn't in conflict with any of these, except for maybe 11.
And one, probably.
Yeah, and one, maybe. But the reason, so, because 12 is really, in a good way, this sounds bad, but it really is good. It's devoid of content, mm-hmm. but it's totally normative.
Right.
And so really what it seemed you were critiquing about the other models was in the way that a commitment to a particular type of action really obscured the task of thinking about what we're doing.
Right.
And really what number 12 is just the affirmation that actions come from understanding. I mean, just action comes from understanding the truth of the Bible. And second, that identity is I phrase it in these silly sort of ways, but identity is capable of movement. Where in all the other things, the identity is you're tied up with a particular mm-hmm. investment of like, oh, I'm about social change. But when you say, I'm about coming to understand the truth and living in light of that. Well, truth is just a notion that is a good notion. It's a normative notion, but it means the outcome of the working of our understanding. I mean, what we come to understand to be true is what's going to be true. If it's social change, it's social change. But if I'm committed to the truth, when I come to understand that maybe this social change thing isn't what the Bible is about, I don't lose my identity.
Right.
You know, because now it's in light of the truth as I understand it now. So that, I mean, I think that what's really great about 12 is you could encourage everyone, except for maybe 1 and 11, to be about it, where they're at. You mm-hmm. know, yeah, sure, be about social change.
Right.
But let's be diligent in how we're that making sure that this action's coming from understanding and not vice versa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the only thing I would add, that's well said, the only thing I would add is that often these other models, however, are going to be so stuck and focused and immovably there that they will look askance. I mean, if you were to come along and say, that's fine, just do this too, their response will be, no, doing that too is wrong.
Right.
That understanding part, that's too intellectual, and they'll have some criticism of it that they will offer, that they will see that as a threat to what they're doing instead of compatible. But you're right, from the standpoint of 12, we see them as entirely compatible.
Right. Yeah. And I think they couldn't help but fall into a performative contradiction. Right. Namely, they're going to try and convince you through the use of their understanding that your action is wrong. And it's right. like, well, if that scheme's true, that's all I'm saying. You know, just realize that's what you're doing when you're really doing your best to be a human. And,
right. Right. Yeah, good. Thanks.
You made a distinction a couple times between the pursuit of intellectual purity or purity of doctrine and the pursuit of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Could you define wisdom?
Well, wisdom, I think, is when you have internalized it so that it's no longer just what your mind gets its mind, what you get your mind around, but it's what you get your being around. So wisdom defines you, not just your intellect. So that's why oftentimes people can be wise and not intellectually sophisticated because for whatever reason their intellectual abilities, their intellectual experience, their educational background and so on doesn't give them the tools to be able to articulate well what it is that they know. But they have known it nonetheless intuitively and they have internalized it. What they have known intuitively has become how they live their life and how they conduct themselves and how they respond to reality.
So is there such a thing as wise actions?
Yes.
Just objective wise actions?
Yeah, I think so.
What's the connection between the internalizing and the... I mean, I'm thinking of something like Proverbs, which is all about wisdom, and it talks about different things you do that are wise in there. So how do you relate the internalizing to the wise actions?
Well, okay, let me give you an example. Take a proverb, something about... this is embarrassing. You know, any proverb.
You want me to give you one?
What is it that turns away, a soft answer turns away wrath? Or whatever?
Yeah.
Well, notice that you could, on the outside, give a soft answer, and it doesn't turn away wrath.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, since it's not internalized, and you're just following a script, it's not real convincing to the other person. They see your hostility, they see your arrogance, they see all the stuff that irritates them, even though, I mean, for example, marriage seminars decades ago, well, husbands, always be prepared to say you're sorry. Well, you learn pretty quickly that, well, I'm sorry, doesn't work. I mean, you said what the seminar said to say, and that's the wise response, but it's got to be convincing. And in order for it to be convincing, it has to come out of wisdom. That is, it has to be something that I've internalized, that is reflecting what I really am committed to, what I really value, and what I really think.
So it's a pursuit of authentic actions.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Right. Did you have a...
Aside from wondering how much you might have aged yourself with the whole Peter, Paul, and Mary comment, I was kind of wondering, you know, is it possible that you think that with, given our innate personalities that God's given us, that we might go through some of the first models as a way to get to God?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I've been through all of them. and they're very compelling. And largely because, for the most part, most of them have some semblance of truth in them. There's some aspect, an element of truth. And we are attracted to that, and we're interested in that. It's just that we're not grounded in the truth of truths, and therefore we're easily dislodged from one element of truth to another element of truth to another element of truth without having any sort of grounding in what discipleship is really all about, such that I can put them all in perspective and see the coherence between them. So, yeah, it's not at all unlikely that in our own personal journeys we have been taught tremendously by several of these other models along the way. Yeah, but I think 12 is where we need to end up. Okay, I've kept you way, way too long. So I'll, if you have questions, I'll stay up here, but I need to let you go.